All right. Welcome to Humans of Grappling. I'm here with Coach Greg Souders, who's been making the grappling podcast rounds, talking about his ecological method or playing games method of coaching. Greg, thanks for coming on.
Hey, you're welcome, Serge. I'm glad to be here.
Awesome. So, yeah, I'm a big fan. I only heard about you last week, and I've
Oh, for real?
It just, yeah, I've just consumed all the podcasts or most of the podcasts that you've been on. So, I've been really trying to absorb what you've been describing and sort of how you mentioned Rob Gray as your professor and he doesn't know it. You're kind of starting to become that for me. So it's
I've learned a ton. I'm flattered. Yeah. Oh, great, man. Fantastic. That's the whole purpose of me doing this, right? I'm trying to spread the word.
Yeah. So, yeah, the whole idea of playing games to teach skills is super exciting to me. And as someone who's been training for a bit, we've kind of seen this debate between the two camps of drilling and anti-drilling. Drillers like Andre Galval with the actual book Drill to Win, Mendo's Bros. Yeah. Robert Eagle is big into drilling. But your approach is in the anti-drilling camp, where it's Kit Dale is famously he was a black belt in 4 years or whatever. Keenan, who's come out, and I think he was your teammate at one point, right?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Who also came from that drill-heavy Team Lloyd Irvin camp, but now he's anti-drilling and others. So, where's your message compared to your fellow anti-drillers out there?
Well, I mean, I think it's more complex than saying either drill or not drill. I think it's how we define practice in general and what we focus our attention on. Mm-hmm. I think we really have to understand the effects of practice design, right? So when we design the way we interact with one bit of information or another, we change the effect of the outcome. So I think we need to be clear about what practice should entail based on the intention of the practice. What do we want? What outcome are we looking for as we practice this sport? And I think traditionally drilling just doesn't solve the problem that we're looking into. So I think for me, the big difference is I just go hard in one direction. Everyone's heard me say this a million times. I don't show technique. This doesn't mean I don't give information. Don't get me wrong. I just don't show technique. We teach students to acquire skill by layering behaviors or starting with what we would call foundational behaviors. And I could be more specific about that. And then we build from there.
Sure. Awesome. Yeah, I might Lex Friedman you along the way to ask you to define your terms you use a lot of terms and it took me a handful of podcasts to go through and really understand what they mean, but the wealth that you've already spread out there is incredible. So I think a lot of people can take just your podcast and start running with it
And that's why I did them that way. So that's why I didn't hold back. That's why I shared my information openly. I talked about my whole conceptual framework. I talked about my foundational approach. I wanted to show people that I'm really giving real information and I'm not just trying to sell something. Now, even though now I'm taking on prospective students, which they're going to pay for it. But I mean, at the same time, I'm not going to stop sharing this information. I'm not going to stop giving away free content.
Yeah, that's awesome. I really appreciate that. I'm sure the whole community appreciates that.
Oh yeah, I've had so much great feedback from everybody. So anyone listening, again, thanks a lot for all of it, man. You guys are fantastic.
Yeah, awesome. So to get a sense of the playing games, where on the spectrum does it in terms of intensity, from say flow rolling, very light to situational or positional sparring, to live rolling and even the competition, where on the spectrum would you say falls in terms of intensity, or is it a different thing altogether?
Well, so what you're talking about is something we call the scaling problem.
Sure.
So the idea is how much effort do we need to do anything? And the truth is any effort, and we can't really control that. So the argument I've been giving in this case is we don't have a mechanism in our body or in our mind to say, oh, this is 37%, this is 47%, this is 50%. Yeah. We don't have that. So we have to find more unique ways to deal with, quote, intensity. And we deal with the scaling problem in two ways. So one is we use time. So I've talked about this before. The lower the time, the higher the urgency, right? Mm-hmm. The longer the time, the lower the urgency. So again, we manipulate these time variables to control urgency. The other way that we deal with it is through how we scale the games. Yeah, so as I was saying, the second way that we solve the scaling problem is through shrinking of task focus. So what we'll do is we'll take some of the variability out of the situation. So you've heard me say this before. If you've listened to other podcasts, we talk about this high variability and low variability. And low variability just means the decisions that have to be made in the situation that we're starting the students in is relatively low, right? And the things that can happen in the situation are relatively low. So an example would be holding somebody in the mount is less variable than passing somebody's guard or trying to take somebody down. So again, to control for scaling, we use time and we use low variability task focus to help manage that.
Gotcha. So it's, I guess what, so the managing the effort is coming, is comes down to like the psychological component of like each person perceiving how short of time there is.
Yeah, because you know, you're dealing with a bunch of different psychologies and a bunch of different, I mean, bodies completely. I mean, some people are calm by nature and passive, and some people are aggressive and hyper. And the thing is we kind of have to let them all mix together, because the system needs to organize not only around the task that we set for them, but each person's individual body and each person's individual psychology. And what we realize is that over time, this starts to work itself out. As students become more skilled and more comfortable with the environment, both mentally and physically, people just tend to be more calm. You know, every beginner is twitchy, every beginner is sloppy, every beginner has bad balance, but that's why they're a beginner. And so as coaches, rather than trying to like frustratingly get this noise out of the system and think like this, move like this, be more athletic, man, you can't say that. People have to be able to do it on their own. And you, as like I said, as a coach, you got to find creative ways to solve this problem.
Gotcha. Yeah, so it's sort of like what my coaches always say is like the most dangerous guy in the room is the guy who just walked in off the street. Like the black belt who's been training 10, 15 years, like they're not going to hurt you unless they really want to, right?
For sure. I mean, I literally hurt nobody. And that's the kind of thing I say. Like, you know, people come to visit the gym and, you know, an instructor, you know, oh, you know, don't go hard on me. I'm like, I'm never going to hurt you. I'm only going to go as hard as I have to. And you're a new guy, so I probably don't have to go that hard. So, you know, don't worry about it. I was like, what you need to be scared of is Mr. Muscles over there with the sleeveless shirt. You're still wearing basketball shorts. Don't go touch him, you know? So,
yeah. Right. Like, I think of it like minimum effective force. Like, you want to use the smallest amount of, like, effort in order to get a technique to work.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is like a little cultural thing I always say to the room. I always say, move as hard as you have to. And that might not mean much at first, but then once you start experiencing fatigue, you're going to think differently about your actions. You know, the first day in training, everyone gasses, even if they have a little bit of experience. And especially because of the way we do things at my gym, you know, we're high frequency, high volume. So, you know, the first time you come in and you're expecting to be like the other gym you just tried the class at, you're going to gas within 30 minutes. So then again, experiencing fatigue, getting comfortable with the situation, these two things merging together sort of help orient this, you know, chaotic, explosive, twitchy individual.
Gotcha. So what's like the adaptation curve you see? So like how long do you notice your fresh off the street white belts, like getting used to the rigors of your practice compared to like, yeah, the one down the street? How soon do they chill out, I guess?
Well, it really depends on their frequency. So, you know, we get guys who come in and they're right away 4 days a week. I would see a change in these guys in 2 to 3 months. I mean, like a permanent change where they're different people. My most recent, I used this example last time, is this kid Kyle, who's now part of the competition team. He was like kind of like a sort of a passive kid, you know, no real physical attributes, but really interested. The first day, he had like run outside 20 minutes in. He's like gasping here, like, and then every day it got a little less and less and less. And then about 2 months in, he's not going outside anymore. He's having a great time, you know. And then on his third month, I was like, do you like this stuff? Are you going to continue training this volume? He's like, oh, I love it. And I was like, hey, come with us, man. Come to my side. And because I split the levels. So I was like, you know, come to these series of classes and you know, join us. Anyway, I saw that. And this is like, this is a regular guy. I mean, he played baseball. But he's not a typical athlete where, you know, he has muscle showing and stuff like that. He's just a regular kid, came in 4 days a week, got acclimated within 2 months, and now he's, you know, doing 8-10 minute rounds a night.
That's awesome. Yeah, and that's sort of a expression of jiu-jitsu where, like the just it's a superpower that enables if you just have the aptitude or not the, not necessarily aptitude right away, but like the attitude. Like if you are the type of person who wants to get in and like learn this, anybody can of any body type can like come and learn these skills and become proficient and be able to defend themselves or compete or whatever.
Well, I think that's the beauty of weight class sports in general. Any sport where we have a weight class, I mean, I think the physical demand is a little bit lower because there's many different ways you can express yourself at a specific weight when you're dealing with people that are sort of built like you. And of course, since jiu-jitsu is such a highly variable art form or a martial art, you can solve the, you know, the objective of the game many different ways. So, yeah, no, I think absolutely right.
That's cool. I guess backing up a bit, like I named this podcast Humans of Grappling. So it's more like getting to know the person behind, like what, why you grapple, like what drew you to grappling. And, I guess what drew you to grappling and what, in your case, like what drew you to your unique method of coaching?
Honestly, no one's ever asked me that. And so I'm kind of shy to tell my story because I'm sort of a different person, than most of you guys coming into the gym. I'm your average, you know, raised by a single mother street kid who really enjoyed confrontation and getting into trouble. So fighting and confrontation and being disagreeable and arguing with authority, that was kind of me, you know. And so fighting and or stuff like that, it attracted me early. When I was a kid, I thought I wanted to be a boxer. So I was always, you know, begging my mom to send me to boxing gyms and whatever. We could only find karate gyms, but I only went to the ones that where they sparred, and I only cared about the sparring classes. So, you know, I was sort of in that vein already. And then I saw this Gracie in Action tape. I don't know if you've ever seen those, but they're amazing. Basically, the Gracies were filming themselves dojo storming all these different schools and doing these challenge matches, and we're just beating the crap out of people using jiu-jitsu. And I saw that, and I was like, I'm in. And so in my teenage years, I searched everywhere for schools that did this, you know, Gracie Jiu-Jitsu or whatever, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I couldn't find it. And then, long story short, I mean, I found a school. I was actually working. I had two jobs at the time. I was installing audiovisual equipment for a company during the day, and then I was working at a video store at night. And I was 19 years old, and some kid came in and asked about some local academy, and I'd never heard of it. But I was like, man, I think I want to do that, you know? So I went online, I found it, went there the next day, because I was on a Monday, showed up on a Tuesday, and I've literally been on the mats every single day since that Tuesday. Bar any serious injuries, which of course I've had, but yeah, I've been a mat rat since that day.
Gotcha. That's awesome. And I guess what, like, I understand you have you competed a lot and you got a neck injury and you had to like more focus on coaching. Like what drew you to like, where'd you first hear about this ecological approach and like what drew you to it?
So really, I mean, I didn't hear anything like this until 2013, 2014. I was always fascinated by how we learn things because I remember the first mystery that intrigued me when I looked at jiu-jitsu, and it was Marcelo Garcia. So in 2004, when I started, Marcelo Garcia was the guy on the scene. He was this smaller guy who was incredibly fast and aggressive, get to everyone's back and he would strangle him. He had these cool moves like, you know, using the butterfly guard, using X guard, and everyone was so into this guy. And so was I. I was equally fascinated. And I remember asking myself, how the hell does he do this against people who already know what he's going to do? Like, everybody watches him, but nobody can stop him. Like, that's amazing. And even though it seems simple, it was always been in my mind. And so even early on, I thought I looked at jiu-jitsu differently. I actually found my 2005 blue belt notebook in my mom's basement. So my mom calls me, like, hey, I need you to come get some stuff out of the basement. So I go over to her house, I look into the stuff, and I pick it up. And this was last year, and I hadn't seen this. And my blue belt notes, they're similar to how I look at jiu-jitsu now. So I had broken everything down into, my note just said important positions. And it was like mount, side control, close guard, half guard. They were very simple notes, and everything, it was, you know, cross collar choke, bow and arrow choke, Kimura. It was all the notes were very simplified. Anyway, so I think I just had to lean towards looking into it more deeply. I was always I loved performing it, but I was also curious about the art itself. And then of course, when I became a coach, when I started coaching, and I originally started coaching for Lloyd Irvin. So I was teaching his white belt comp team, and I was teaching his white belt basic classes, and I would fill in anytime he wasn't there. So I'd also teach the competitors too. I like doing that. And then when I started teaching on my own, I just felt this deep intellectual responsibility to know what the fuck I was talking about. I was like, if I create a website and I open a gym and I say, hey man, I'm going to teach you this, well, I better know how to do that. you know, and I just never felt comfortable with the plug and play method of anything. So I started reading books and I bumped into the ecological approach while searching, and, you know, I haven't looked back. If, you know, it was convincing and fascinating all at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. And I have a similar notebook. Like, I don't know where it is right now, but I remember taking, like, notes my first week of jiu-jitsu of, like, and mine were, like, very detailed. And I was, like, because I came up in a traditional school, and it's, like, it was all about, okay, you grab here, you grab here, you grab the collar, whatever. Like, it's, and I wrote, like, as much detail as I could. But, like, I'm a programmer. Like, I'm a software engineer by trade. So it's, like, we generally are lazy and hate memorizing things. So, like, that detail-oriented approach, like, may have never worked for me. Like, I'm more about knowing how the general idea works, or how the formula or the heuristic works. And it's sort of like what you guys teach with the ecological approach. From what I've gathered.
Well, heuristics are just one way we can use information as a constraint. So not only are the games and the conditions constraints, but also the information you give people. And by constraint, we just mean it basically takes away options. So if I tell you something, inadvertently I'm taking away options because I'm telling you, hey, focus on this. Do it this way. Think about it like this. And what that does is it sort of frames your view. And so this is why I think informational constraints are not only are poorly understood, but they're also kind of the most sensitive aspect of what we're doing. I mean, you get better results if you just put tough guys in an environment and say, fight towards this end, than you do when you explain things to people. And so, again, utilizing information is again, I haven't got to talk about that aspect much because everyone wants to ask me about it, but nobody wants to dig into that detail. Because I do use information, but again, I'm careful how I do it.
Sure. Like, you have to tell them something. Like, you have to say some words that you have to set up the game in such a way, and then just kind of let them. And I've looked at your Instagram posts and, like, the class you posted on YouTube, and, like, you're very careful with how you set up the parameters of the game, and you don't, like, you don't give a specific, you just say, this is how you win. However you figure that out, that's kind of up to you.
Well, so there's two things. There's something called a small-sided game, all right? And a small-sided game is just, we start with a very constrained situation and we say, play towards this end, okay? So it's like taking a big open thing and shrinking it to a small thing. So there's gonna be a lot of touches and interactions, and people are gonna be able to focus on a small aspect of the engagement. Now, the second aspect is what's called conditional. So within these small-sided games, there are conditions that need to be met. And so a condition could be something like keep connection to your opponent, try to keep your knees pointed at the center of their chest. I'm giving random ones. Those are the conditions that you want to play within a game. Some of these conditions can be like terminal, like this condition met ends the game, or they could be continuous. Okay, so this condition must be met throughout the entirety of the game. And so we want to make sure, or I want to make sure, that the information I give students are relative to both the size of the game that we're playing, or the constraints of the specific game, and then the conditional constraints of the game. Because this information is something you can perceive from interaction. It's not what I'm saying, but what the student is picking up from doing the action against a resisting opponent.
Gotcha. And I guess to define our terms here, constraint means like rules of the game. Like
So constrain is just, it's like a box you put around things to remove options. So it's, consider it like a funnel. All right. The constraints that we use specifically are trying to funnel two things, your intention and your attention. These two terms I got from a researcher named Gabrielle Wolf, who researches the focus of attention. And so her research was very strong for the ecological community as to answering a question as, what should we focus on? And so her research suggests that it's external sources of focus that allow the body to act more implicitly. So again, anytime we constrain the environment, we want to constrain it in such a way that the options that are available for action are smaller than they otherwise would be. They are noted by a specific intention, i.e. what are we looking for? And B, where are we looking? Where are we focusing our energy and attention? And typically it's externally, something in front of us.
Gotcha.
Does that clarify?
Yeah. So it's, we're trying to, to better define ecology, like to me, ecology, like maybe most people view that as like something to do with birds and trees and like environment kind of stuff, but it deals with like the abstract version of environment.
It's very birds and trees. You know, we're essentially a bird in trees. We're just humans in the world. So really ecological psychology is a study of human behavior. So like how humans interact with their environment performing tasks. So the behavior that emerges from that is the basis of ecological psychology. And so since sport is something humans engage in, we're using the ecological approach to look at sport or to train skill within a sport. So a sport is just a human playing a game or performing a task in that sporting environment. And that environment includes everything from the turf they're playing on or the mats they're wrestling on to the heat in the room, to the moisture in the room, everything. And the tasks are specific to the sport they're playing. So what's the objective of their engagement? What are they doing? Who are they playing it with? You know, for how long?
Gotcha. Yeah. I think that's throwing these like, yeah. I think people get hung up on like, yeah, the no technique part in your like other podcasts, and like they don't like try to like, yeah, define, or they have some other idea of what ecology means or whatever. But yeah, like we're just birds and trees. It's just our trees are the mat and how we interact with each other exactly. In that environment. Yeah,
I mean, the pushback really isn't an informational one. It's an emotional one. When you say technique, they're like, but I paid, you know, for 67 seminars from the greatest coach in the world, and he taught me all the best techniques ever. I mean, all I'm saying when I say I don't teach techniques, I don't give my students solutions to the problem. I'm not going to give you a process-oriented solution. I'm going to give you an opportunity to discover the same thing that I now know in a guided and focused way. So what we're doing is we're removing all the junk in training and trying to make it as, you know, rich as possible. We want the information sources the student to be interacting with to be as real as possible, because we don't want to guide them in such a way that they miss the forest because the trees are in the way. You know, I always say that same thing, but that's how I see it.
Right. Yeah. And definitely. And that's like where, I don't know, as I've like come up the ranks and whatnot, like where I get the most out of training is the live rolling portion, because that's like where I can like test things out and where I can.
Everyone does. It's not just you. Yeah. Literally everyone. I don't care what anyone tells you. It doesn't, like, we don't have a good mechanism to determine why things affect us in the way they do. We don't have this little part in our brain that goes, oh, putting my left hand here, you know, at 90 degrees this many times a day makes me understand this better. We don't know. You know what I mean? We just like to contribute our successes to things that we like. So we have this, you know, emotional dependency upon our experiences and the experience that we find meaningful. But we're not looking at that objectively. I mean, because the true training kind of sucks. Like, do you know how hard 8 10-minute rounds a night, 4 days a week in a row, and then not to mention the 10 10-minute rounds you're about to do on Friday and Saturday, and then some guys come in and do another 5 10-minute rounds on Sunday? Do you know how hard that is for 16 weeks in a row? That shit fucking sucks. You know what I mean? You know how much easier it is to jog around the room with your buddy and talk about the show you watched last night, drill your 30 minutes of technique, and then bar 15 minutes? That's easy. That feels great.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the... I guess the amount that volume and all that kind of stuff, is that like something your guys adapt to, and like now it's like no big deal to them, bumps and bruises?
Let me back up a little bit. I'm not suggesting that anyone do the volume and frequency that we do. I'm not, because we're actually experimenting with something right now. So last year we found our volume limit. So there is a volume limit for people who aren't on steroids, and we found it. and basically, it's around 600 minutes of live grappling a week. And roughly, if you do that for about 16 weeks, like I mentioned, you're going to start getting what we jokingly call sad boy syndrome. So you're going to wake up in the morning and you're going to want to jump off a cliff. It's going to, everything sucks. Your food doesn't taste good. Like nothing in your life works. Like everything, it's bad. So, and I'm only laughing because I had this small group of guys. I'm like, all right, let's find our volume limit. Let's go. And everyone was in. Like one of our guys did 56 days in a row. It was intense. And he's a smaller guy, so he could handle it. Luckily, nobody got hurt. Nobody hurt their knees or shoulders or anything. But emotionally, they took a beating. So, but that was good for us because now we found sort of this volume limit. And so we play with volume. And now my guys all can control their own volume. So we have like kind of a required required frequency throughout the week. But if they're feeling bad, my guys are allowed to control their own volume.
Gotcha. Yeah, because that's part of this like professionalization of the sport is like I know when you always say like you're one of your students calls this the leather helmet era of the sport, and it's like professional teams, like it's not a like if you're on a professional sports team, nobody's questioning you if you're not, right? Like that question doesn't really get raised. Like everyone is at the highest level if you're in the NFL or basketball or whatever. Like it's not about toughness, it's about like skill acquisition and who can prepare better for the opposing team that week. So do you see that with your guys? Like how are you trying to professionalize the sport, I guess?
So, well, first, the group that does that high volume that I just described is a very small select group. We have about 20 people doing it. So, you know, out of the 85 jiu-jitsu students that we have, I would say 20 people train, quote, professionally. Now, this doesn't mean they have to compete. The way we do our competition team is we have the guys who are trying to get out there and be somebody, and then everyone else is their support. So you can't have a room full of guys unless you have a support base. You know, we need guys there every night who are willing to work as hard and push as hard so we can create that strong stimuli for the guys who are about to go out there and test it against the world. So that's the first thing we're doing. We're trying to create a professional team, and that's hard. We're also trying to teach them how to treat themselves professionally, both psychologically and physically. So we constantly discuss diet, sleep, exercise, hydration, rest. We share podcasts with each other. We talk about what we've discovered about ourselves, and we talk to each other when we're feeling bad. Like, we're trying to basically, you know, coalesce around this high volume, high frequency for a purpose. But yeah, so I think that's what I'm trying to do. I'm also trying to fill the coaches space. So, and I'm using my experiential knowledge to do so, but yeah, I mean, basically that's how I'm trying to create this professional environment. Like I said, I'm doing it with my students on an experiential phase, trying to see what works and what doesn't work. And then I'm trying to share my knowledge with people who are willing to listen.
Gotcha. Yeah. I guess another thing that I've noticed like with, at least for myself, like trying to get more out of training is like when I do the live roles, like I film the live roles and like, cause
that's fantastic.
I only have so much, like I'm a busy guy. I only train at 6 a.m. and I don't have like all day to train or anything like that. So, I get, great rounds at 6 a.m. We have a good group of people, but like, I want to get more out of it. So I think I started a trend at the gym of like filming the live roles and like reviewing it and really trying to break that down. And I'm not sure how do you ecologically break down like film?
That's actually a great question. So two things that just kind of interesting. So one, just a little joke. So do you know what an attractor is?
Oh,
ecologically, you hear that word?
No, I feel like you may have said that, and I don't know what that is.
An attractor is just like a type of physical dependence or a psychological dependence on a behavior, and not a dependence in a cognitive sense, but you're unaware of it. So the example that Rob Gray uses in his book, How We Learn to Move, is the Tim Tebow problem. So the idea is that Tim Tebow was this, you know, fantastic college player, considered one of the best college player quarterbacks in history. He goes to the NFL, has a 3-year career, and just gets bombed out, right? And it was, what they were charging with is the way he stood and held the ball. So I don't know enough about football, but I'm only regurgitating what I read, that Tim Tebow held the ball too low. So he couldn't get it out and release it fast enough before he'd get rushed, right? So his accuracy was all over the place. And so the coaches went about trying to change this. They wanted him to hold the ball higher. So his propensity to hold the ball low is an attractor, okay? It's something that he preferred to organize his body around the information he's perceiving as it related to him getting the ball out, okay? So Now, what attractors do is they tend to stabilize. So there's many reasons why a tractor will stabilize, but most of the reason it stabilizes is because of success. So it gets reinforced. And so we call this reinforcement an attractor well. And just think of like a valley, right? So an attractor, like a little ball, and there's like this big valley, and the ball gets stuck down in that valley. Now, what ends up happening is that it through practice and through everything that we do and everything we develop these attractors, some good, some bad. Okay, some are great. Like for his the way he played in college, it was a great attractor for him. But when he moved out to the professional level, it was a negative. So the coach's role then becomes to perturb that valley. Like you need to shake it up so much that we break apart that perception action link towards that specific behavior to get a new behavior that's going to be more successful in the current situation that he's trying to experience his ability to, or his skill of throwing ball. But they couldn't get it to change. They just could not get it to, he couldn't organize around the other way. And so he ended up not having any success, or excuse me, in his field. I'm not saying the guy's not successful, you know, I'm saying in his way. So what video does is it allows a student to find those. So let's say, you know, you're in practice and you're organizing around all this stuff. Sometimes you're not aware of everything that's happening and you're not aware about the behaviors that are emerging from your practice. But if, when you look at yourself from a third eye or you know, a secondary point of view, you can see this. Oh my God, I'm holding my hand in this way. Like this is causing lots of problems for me here. I'm missing the grip connection, or I'm not able to destabilize in the direction I want to well. So you just notice an attractor, and because you watched it from a third-party view, it's easier for you to recognize it because you might not have been aware of it while doing it. And this can be the way you coach yourself. And then that is the second thing I was going to say. Me and my guys were joking the other night. Coaches are only attractor finders. Like that's really my job. It's like I'm a hired attractor finder because I'm watching the room, and I have to either create them, or fix them, or manipulate them in some way that whatever behaviors stick. Well enough to be successful, but not so deep that they punish us as we reach different levels of variability.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's really interesting because, yeah, I feel like for example, like my favorite sweep is deep half. And like I have this kind of idea of whenever I can get my two legs around their one leg, I can get into deep half and I can get into like arm under. And I've done this like thousands of times over, like I've been training like 10 years. So I have like this, it's not just like one technique. It like I can find it in a variety of different ways. So I feel like that, like that's a well for me, but
yeah, exactly.
And that's a, and it's sort of gotten me in trouble in some circumstances. And I've like tried to like hammer out all the different like situations that come up, or like how the different ways it can be defeated. But yeah, there's also like, is it a local, maxima? Like, I think Stefan, Kesting like talked about, it's like when you, do stuff and it works, is it like the best that you can get at, or is there better? But I know you mentioned that you don't think there is like a best.
No, because let's say you had a guy who didn't line up with the center line well and didn't know how to use your levers to pin you. Deep half is probably highly successful for you, right? But if you have a guy who's highly stable who lines up with the center well and knows how to use your arms as levers, you're fucked. You're gonna get Kimura, you get your back taken, you get your guard pass, you get pinned to the mat. Right. So it's going to be a big issue for you. I'm sorry. Can you hear my dog barking?
No, that's fine.
My bad.
That's all good.
He's in the room, but he's barking at something.
That's all good. Yeah, definitely. So I guess the videoing, to get back to like video film study. So that's useful because it's self, like you're providing yourself with information rather than and you can like reference what the knowledge that you have, how you felt at that moment, or how things are during that role. Like you have knowledge of that versus like watching a Danaher DVD and you try to remember what happened. Is there, I guess, what's the difference between self-film study and like instructional study?
So I don't watch instructionals because I noticed this, and it was funny because when I was before I was teaching, I noticed this myself. I used to love instructionals. I have a box. The last instructional I bought was actually Danaher's leg stuff because I knew nothing about legs, and I was very curious about how he put the project together. So anyway, I noticed that when I would try to replicate what he was saying, I did a worse job than I might just organize it around what I was seeing. And I noticed this previous too, because I was huge into DVD buying when I was a new student. So basically from 2004 to 2008, if a world champ or a top rated guy had a DVD, I had it. And I would consume this information. I would go nuts with it. But I always felt anytime I tried to replicate what was in front of me, I did a worse and worse job, and especially over time. So there was this really interesting thing I noticed. I'd be able to do it new right away when it was novel, but then as my opponent started to adapt, because maybe I hit it once or twice, it wouldn't work anymore. And then ultimately I come to realize it's because when you see a technique, you're only seeing a step-by-step process in a given situation. But remember, you need to adjust because you're never the same person, and your opponents will adjust because they're never the same person. So if we learn a step-by-step technical approach to solve a problem, there's going to have to be other factors around that process that help anchor us to why we are taking one action over another. Because if we don't have that secondary thing, man, we're going to get stuck in that hole where we can only perform these actions if the situation lines up perfectly.
Right. So it's sort of like a glass cannon kind of thing, where it's not a movable, like it'll be really good, like one, like in one specific way, but if you change it up ever so slightly, it won't work.
Typically, yes. I mean, that's sort of what happens. I mean, you can take a simple concept, right? So like everyone used to talk about, you know, when you're in side control and the elbow that's closest to you, everyone talks about moving that elbow out of the way. That's not easy to do. And when people used to teach it, I remember they said, oh, just move your knee down to the hip and open it up. Something as simple as that. Dude, it never works that way. Never. You know, like maybe one time in a transition where we're going from north-south to side control, some guy's rotating, we can catch it. But forcing it to happen, the way they're showing it, dude, it never happens that way. So I think that let's not learn something in that technical way where, okay, this has to happen in this way. Instead, we say, I want this to happen. Figure out how you can make it happen, right? Or like start focusing on this aspect of their body when you're moving. And if you sense elbow exposure, fill the gap. There's a a bunch of different ways you can approach getting people to look at that as a thing if it is something that's going to solve a problem. But typically the technical explanation might work once when neither player is aware of what the hell is happening, but the second we start adjusting to it, it tends to fail.
Right, and what you've mentioned before is like that it makes more robust solutions, like this approach of like playing games, and like you really like sit in this situation, you're in the pocket with this other person who's like actively trying to like mess up what you're doing, and you figure out all these like nooks and crannies of like what about this thing happens or that thing happens, and people learn for themselves. And is that representative of
for sure techniques tend to be what's called brittle, meaning they're very subject to perturbations or changes in the environment. So a technical explanation, it needs a series of steps to be perfect in order for the outcome to happen the way you planned it. And so again, it's brittle. It doesn't adapt to change. Whereas something that you've self-organized around based on invariance and variability, it gives you access to solving that problem many different ways, which makes the technique robust or less prone to perturbation or changes. And then ultimately, if it can be adapted in many different ways, it becomes flexible, meaning it can be achieved using different aspects of your body at different angles at different times.
Gotcha. Yeah. And this is like to like connect it with like something in like the computer science realm. This is sort of like machine learning, where like big data, like companies like suck up all this data about you, like Facebook and Google or whatever. They train these like machine learning models, like neural networks and things like that, and they get a sense of like who you are and what they can advertise to you and things like that. So, but for people who like feed it garbage data about yourself, say like you you start a new, whatever, you open up a new computer and you start like doing something that's completely out of your ordinary, like you're feeding that them garbage data to like advertising you, then they give you like garbage advertisements. Like say you're a cat person, but you click on images of dogs and you like whatever, look at videos of dogs, and then it's like giving you the wrong like advertisements, right? So sort of like here we're trying to like give ourselves good inputs, train our neural networks in a such a way that we're giving ourselves good quality, like I'm trying to say, not to say reps, but like time in a position or alignment, I think is what you call it, and giving ourselves like training our models on the these like reactions that people like actually give you in real time versus like this kind of fake constructed step-by-step technical definition.
Well, for sure, because anything done step-by-step or in a static way doesn't actually have what we call specifying information. So let's say I have to do a movement pattern where I have to apply weight to somebody in a specific way to get a specific outcome. Now, in a real environment, you're going to be receiving pushback. Someone's going to be pushing back against you while you're trying to achieve that outcome. But in a static environment, nobody's pushing back against you. So the movement solution that will emerge against the non-resistant opponent will be different than the movement solution against the resisting opponent because of that informational exchange. When you're dealing with a static opponent, the only information that's present is the tension on their skin or the weight of their arm or just like a dead weight in front of you. But again, a resisting body presents different information, both in, you know, kinesthetic awareness and, you know, optic awareness and balance. I mean, all these things, right? So again, we can only organize ourselves into a true skill playing the game that we're ultimately going to play, you know, because again, our skill has to be representative, and representative basically just means it has to be applicable to the game at large. So nothing learned in a static way or even in a flow state is applicable to a live resisting opponent, because in a live resisting opponent, one, doesn't flow, and two, is never holding still. And if they are doing either, they're going to get beat.
Right. So, okay. So you're coming out against flow rolling is that flow as in like the flow state of mind or a flow?
No,
like anything
I'm coming
less
out right? against, I'm coming out against anything that's not representative.
Sure.
Again, I don't like using percentages because there's no such thing. Like,
sure.
You're either trying or you're not trying. You're either resisting or you're not resisting. Everything is a degree, right? So,
I see.
Like, let's say I'm going with a beginner. They could be going full bore, and it doesn't feel like resistance to me because they're not aligning themselves appropriately to the task. So it feels easy. But if you know, me and D are rolling, and he's feeling particularly chippy that day and wants to, you know, put me down, it's going to be a brawl, you know? So intensity changes. You know, it must be real. It must be an exchange between the two people. It can't be, like, preordained. Because even flow rolling, even though there's, quote, aliveness or resistance to it, that's never represented in the performance environment.
Sure, yeah. That's not – nobody's going to flow with you at ADCC trials and, like, to let you warm up or anything like that. There isn't agreed upon, like, one-minute warm-up and then, oh, we're going to go for real after that, so – okay.
Yeah, this is not a thing. So, I mean, that's all I'm saying. And understand, too, that we can change our energy inputs, right? So if I'm feeling particularly tired that day, I just don't go as hard. I let my opponent kind of beat on me a little bit. Or, you know, I try to match their pace as closely as I need to win the exchanges that I decide to win. But either way, I'm adapting to my opponent's real inputs. So as he is attacking me and interacting with me, regardless of how he's going, it's really up to me to decide how I respond. But either way, I'm getting real information in real time, and that's the only thing that's going to produce any reliable skill.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's interesting how you, yeah. I feel like in terms of, it's interesting something you said there, where it's like, I determine how much energy I'm putting into this. Where, like, yeah, a white belt doesn't understand that, or they don't quite understand, like, not going 100%, and... whatever, trying to win every single round. But I think I have this thing where it's like I'm mostly in control of whether I get hurt or not. Like whether I push back or like meet that force largely determines how hurt or beat up I get. I'm not sure.
No, for sure. No, I know you're absolutely right. I do the same thing. I mean, I've had 4 surgeries and I'm 38 and I've been training for 18 years. So, I mean, like I'm beat up, you know, I have neurological issues from my neck damage. I mean, I got all kinds of stuff. So, you know, I have to manage myself well. You know, it's up to me to choose my training partners and decide what I'm going to do. But the thing is, I'm not going to tell some guy like, oh, I want you to only go, man, I'm just going to pick my partners intelligently. I'm going to do what I can to deal with what's in front of me. Now we have to understand that, you know, any beginner in any sport is the highest risk of getting hurt, and they're going to be sloppy and they're going to use all their energy, but that's okay. Like I said, we can solve that. We don't need to like try to intellectualize, because even if we do, we remove something that's kind of special. We remove that real interaction with the environment. We don't want to remove it. We just want to guide it. We want to find a creative way to let them be them, but make sure that them being them is going to benefit not only themselves, but their partner as well. And so, yeah, like I said, I never tell people to calm down. If I get a super wild dude, I just say, hey, you're going to do a 10-minute round today. I'm going to put you over here with this guy. And that will calm him down real quick, because he won't be able to do that for the whole class, you know? And so, like I said, it's stupid anyway, because even if I tell him to flow or chill, again, he's going to be notchy and rigid, and it's going to remove his ability to communicate well with his own body and with the environment. It's just going to mess it all up.
That makes sense. And yeah, that definitely putting that into context, because yeah, I'm certainly guilty of like telling people to like calm the fuck down and chill, and like because I have control over it, like I can control like myself and turn myself down. But yeah, trying to figure out how to drive that concept or teach them in that way, like like you said, expand the time parameters to like so they can't go 1,000% for 10 minutes, like they'll burn out. So
yeah, because like what if like, you're a guy who's trained before and I'm a guy who's trained before, what if we rolled together and was like, dude, you're going too hard, I want you to go at 42%? That would like fuck your whole roll up. You're like, what is 42%? Sure. Do we have a different definition of that? Where am I going too hard? You might not even know. So really, I mean, you know, if we're talking about skilled players with unskilled players, then it's the skilled player's responsibility to control the situation. And if you can't, you're probably not as skilled as you think you are.
True.
So I never tell anybody anything. I'm like, my partner shakes hands. I'm like, listen, if you don't try to beat my ass, I'm never rolling with you again. Let's go. You know,
right.
I let the people more comfortable with being themselves. Like if I get a really athletic dude, I'm like, great, keep being athletic. If I get a really strong guy, I'm like, sweet, keep being strong. It's like, can you imagine blaming smartness? Imagine if you have a really highly intelligent guy who's a great problem solver physically, and you're like, dude, you're too intelligent, you need to turn it down. Like,
right.
we want to enhance our students' attributes. We just want to make sure they're beneficial to them and not hindrances.
True. Yeah, definitely. And would you say that's, I guess, yeah, their attributes is like it's a hardware and software problem. So it's like their attributes, what they come in with, body type, speed, whatever they, flexibility, those are, yeah, hardware attributes versus, yeah, the software that we're trying to teach with like the skill acquisition of jiu-jitsu, like that's the real lever. And that, like, that's what people are, that's the real thing that can take somebody who's super unathletic but appear to be whatever super strong to somebody using their structure and physics and whatnot, holding somebody down who's like twice their size.
Well, for sure, because even that like big strong athletic guy who comes in with that pre-attribute that's going to allow him to sort of inefficiently win, that's fine, but he'll hit a wall. And so again, it's the coach's job. We have to be creative. We have to be like, okay, how can I challenge this guy in such a way to remove that attractor and give him a new effectivity that takes the place of that attractor, right? That's our job. So if you want to change something about your overly strong guy, you have to find a way to get them to change it. Because it's their realization based on their desired outcome of their practice or whatever. that's ultimately going to give them that permanent change. That them choosing and them discovering is a thing that's going to make whatever change you want stick. You know, so again, it's convincing them in a way that you don't sound like you're being convincing.
Sure,
it's,
like
it's
you're
letting practice do the work for you.
Yeah, you're incepting the idea. You get them to you put them in a position where like trying to I don't know like the bench pressing like as a mount escape or something like that. Maybe that becomes not as efficient. They get tired out or whatever, or bench pressing out of side control. Like that's
Well, that's actually what I start with. So when I teach beginners how to escape bottom position, I teach them to push. And so, you know, people are going to, this goes out, people listen, I'm probably going to be all over Reddit, like, man, he sucks, he talks, tells them to push. But the reason I tell them to push is the first person, I said this before, the first person we have to learn how to beat is the ignorant antagonist. We have to know how to deal with the push. And the person pushing has to realize the limits of the push. Because I can't turn a push into a frame until I can get that push to fail. Because if I have a bunch of students pushing each other off the mount and they're having success across the room, there's something wrong. That means the person on mount who's in the more efficient position should be able to remove what's pushing on them and hold the person down. But if the bottom person's push is so good that they never have to change that behavior, why would they? So first I have to get the behavior to break. I have to break it. So I let them do the thing that's going to be the most easy thing for the beginner to do. Every beginner can push somebody off them, and they should. Because every person on top needs to learn how to deal with the basic push. And then what happens is we further orient the situation to help them learn how to more efficiently use their push, how to line it up, how to use a straight frame versus a bent frame. And we do this by letting them let their attractors, quote, break. We give them one, and then we break it. We give them one, and then we break it. And then eventually you get this efficient skill.
Gotcha. And the attractors breaking... have you, well, I guess this is sort of related is like, so you have all these constraints and you're trying to like figure out a way to show people new attractors or whatever. And this is sort of like, I'm also relaying this to like AI where like programs like AlphaGo, like they self-play where they figure out ways to that like AlphaGo apparently does like non-human types of moves or like very unorthodox types of play because it just played the game so much way beyond any human could like ever play it. So there's like new emergent behaviors given this like self-play constraint. So have you like seen like new things come up because you've been putting people in these different types of games?
Well, not new things per se, but each person has a quality to them that another person doesn't have. And this is what I like to see emerge. So the only things wrong with the computer example is that you have an organism, and I'm just saying that because I'm using the ecological triangle, not that, you know,
sure.
Alpha zero is actually an organism. You might be, who knows, right? But just kidding. But he's operating on a level of degree as it relates to advantage that we can't imagine. So the reason it's non-human is because he can play himself a million times, you know, every few minutes. And so his experiential knowledge is experiencing a degree of success versus failure that we can't. And so maybe losing this piece at this time, at this game against this piece gives such a degree of a positional or a material advantage that 20 moves later, it's going to pay off. We don't operate at that level of degree. But anyway, so... With people, we all pretty much operate at the same degree. So you're going to see like interesting things emerge from each person, but it's always going to look like a human coming up with something. No one's ever going to blow your mind and be like, oh my God, I've never seen that before. And typically, even if something new does emerge, I'll go over to the student. I'm like, well, keep doing that. Let's see if we can turn that into something, especially if it's novel, because maybe we found something stable. Maybe we found something new, a new answer to the problem. But again, I mean, that doesn't happen often.
Sure. Yeah. But I'm just curious because this is like I don't know how many other people have been doing this type of practice. I'm not sure if new things pop up or, this is the root of innovation of like somebody had to do like, since I trained 10th Planet, Eddie Bravo had to do rubber guard for the first time at some point and he had to get it from somewhere, or like he had to get it from his environment. He had to see that he was able to like create this whatever way of clinching and using his leg to like keep people down, make it act like a gi in a no-gi situation.
Yeah, and that's actually what's really cool about that. I mean, he's a good example too. So like, you know, John Danaher made this popular a while back, but it's the objective problem solution style of thinking. So he said, you know, every situation has a central problem. And if we're talking about closed guard, what we're dealing with is the spine lever relative to the hips and shoulders. So we're trying to get someone closer to us or go closer to them so we can attack that line, because the shoulder line, including both arms and the neck, are right there in front of us. And with the gi on, traditionally, you had to break posture to do that. So we couldn't access the collar unless the player was closer to us. And the best way to affect the spine lever is anything interact with anything from the shoulders up, because those are the points at the end of the lever, right? So we have to pull on it. And so Eddie Bravo, being a flexible guy, a fast, dexterous guy, used his legs as a collar, as you guys already know. I mean, everyone knows the story. But he literally came up with that based on the problem he was facing in the constraints of the no-gi environment. He found a movement solution that solved a particular problem. Now, what's really interesting is in solving that problem, he actually created a new one. So the issue with rubber guard in general is that it doesn't allow you to change the angle perpendicular very easily. Since you're holding on to your leg and you're pinning your knee and shin against the shoulder, you can't rotate as easily if you didn't have it like that. So he had to come up with other ways to solve that, I guess you could call the rotation problem, or the, you know, the angle change problem. And so, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that's kind of, so I guess that's a way to like get people to, I don't know, to incept people, get people on board with the ecological approaches to like say, okay, how would you solve this problem? Or how, and that's in, like you say, like the historical,
historical emergence.
Yeah. Like just, okay, somebody had to do this thing first, and what affordances did they see to, like, do that? I know I'm probably using the terms wrong, but, like...
No, it's not bad.
Yeah. So, I guess, what are affordances and what... I get going deep here.
No, it's good. I'm glad you asked that one, because nobody asked me that yet. It's funny. Affordance is just a fancy word for specifying information. The information present in the environment affords us an opportunity for action. So if we have a hand that can grasp, things in the environment look graspable. So graspability is an affordance. So a posted hand on the mat is graspable in a specific way relative to our position. So it has the affordance of graspability. So again, it's just affords, just specifying information, things that our eyes and our body picks up to organize around. Right, so it's how the environment and organism directly affect each other. And what you'll hear is they say perception is direct, or the ecological approach believes that information is direct, perception is direct. And all this means is that there's a direct link between our actions and our experiences in the environment, that all the information we need to organize into a new movement solution or into a behavior is present in front of us and also present within us. It's like this relationship that they call the perception-action link, right? They both affect each other. It's not like a chicken or egg thing. It's like they're intricately linked, like they're embodied. Like, you know, it's not, yeah. So, anyway, affordance is just specifying information.
Gotcha, cool. Yeah, and that perception-action, I don't know, I'm going to use, like, non-scientific terms, but it's like we have proprioception. Like, we have to be very in tune with what everything in our body is doing. Like, we have to... Everything has to be strategically placed in order, like in front of people to like retain guard, or our legs and feet, we want them between us and our opponent, or where our hands are placed and whatever. So I think there's lots of like data in perceiving where all of those move, and it's that's something lost in like instructionals. Like you don't, Danaher can't tell you like what this feels like.
Nobody can.
Right. Yeah.
It's called transitional information. We don't have access to it. So proprioception is just our sense of where our limbs are in space. And we don't have access to proprioception. It's just something our bodies experience, and that when moving through space. And so we use it to organize. So if, let's say some people have a stronger, proprioceptive leaning, they tend to be more athletic. People that don't tend to be less athletic, but you really, it's hard to affect that, because again, we can't tap into it. and be like, focus on where your hand is, because that actually makes things worse. So you actually become more explicit and notchy if you focus on your own body. You become more implicit and fluid when you focus externally. So even though proprioception is something that we use, we don't have like direct conscious access to it. It's something that just is there. And if we do try to access it, we end up messing ourselves up.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. Because, yeah, you want to be, like totally focused on just the task at hand of, like, the person in front of you. You don't want to, like, be thinking about thinking or, like, thinking about, like, remembering what coach told you to do or whatever. Like, you just want to be able to, like, move your limbs in the right way at the right time.
Right time is momentarily dependent. You know, it's not. There is no one moment or one time or one rightness. That changes constantly.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Like, I think you've mentioned it's a real-time strategy game. It's not turn-based. It's not chess.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all. No. I mean, there's similarities. Anytime we get these expressions of war, you'll see these similar tactics and strategies emerge because it's a very – I mean, basically – you know, we're all fighting over, you know, space, time, and material, right? So our time in the physical game is fatigue. Like, who's going to use this time more efficiently? Because some of us are going to experience fatigue. Material is what piece of our body are engaged with other pieces of body at any given time. And then space is basically where we are relative to each other. So we're trying to take space from each other. We're trying to limit utility of limbs, which is material. And then we're manipulating people's energy, which is time. And so in chess, that's what you do. You manipulate those three things as well. And so there tends to be similarities between the tactics and strategies in any war game.
Yeah, that's dope. Yeah, I haven't thought about... Yeah, like, yeah, chess, like, they talk about, yeah, taking material. Well, that's taking position. Like, you advancing on your opponent, and it's a zero-sum game. Like, what's good for me is bad for you, or whatever.
Yep. So it's just,
yeah, that's cool.
But it's just not turn-based. That's it. I mean, that's just...
Sure,
just,
exactly. Yeah.
So I can go like 37 times in a row, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So this ecological approach, like, it feels... I'm like so like... I want to like learn so much more about it because it feels like a more direct lever to increase the overall grappling skill of the world. Like, this feels like it's a foundational change that could like widely impact the sport.
I think ultimately when coaches get on board and they start practicing, it's going to revolutionize all sports. I think that I almost felt it right away when I first read the first paper on self-organization. It was like, I couldn't believe what I was reading. I was like, this is crazy. Like, it was convincing immediately. And so as soon as I started applying it, I couldn't believe the results I was getting. I was like, there's no way. And then it even got crazier when I started researching and realized nobody else is using it. And I'm like, what is everybody doing? Like, we have gold here in front of us, and nobody wants to grasp it because they're too emotionally attached to what their instructor told them before. I'm like, dang, guys, you really don't want to get better. So, yeah, but I think it's going to revolutionize all sports. I mean, all the college teams that are using it are having massive success. You know, the international teams, they're having massive success. So, I mean, you know, it's awesome.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, I feel like that's, like, it's sort of, sorry, I heard some feedback there for me. But where, I guess, my passion is like, trying to, like, figure out ways, like, because I'm in software, it's like, okay, how software can, like, increase leverage in the world. Like, we can automate things and process things and do things are way faster than a normal human, and like trying to find ways to like increase the percentage of like total grappling skill by like this method is like a gigantic lever in that way. It's an entirely new way to like encode our software and how we encode these skills in our brain.
No, I feel so too. I mean, you know, once we become, you know, more open to the environment, we're adaptable, more flexible. I mean, you're going to see new movement solutions emerge on a more regular basis. I think people are going to get involved quicker. They're going to, everything's going to happen at a little bit of a faster rate if everything else is equal. I mean, we as coaches really have to learn how to use the method, and I've been painstakingly trying. I mean, like I said, back in 2018 now is when I first started the full-on process where I pretty much just said, fuck it, we're going full tilt, let's go. It was hard. You know, I was so insecure. I had no idea what I was doing. I was so full of doubt. I just kind of like gritted my teeth and took it. And I was like, I believe in this. It's going to work. And luckily I did that. So,
yeah. Right. Yeah, that's awesome. And I guess with since you have so much experience and time, like trying to craft these different games to increase skills, like do you have a favorite one? Do you have one that you're particularly proud of or that is clever that kind of comes to mind?
Honestly, I think I'm more simple than I am clever. I think the thing I do well is I distill information to what I would consider like necessary information, like fundamental things. And I'm sort of obsessed with fundamentals. So I guess I'm proud. I don't know if that's the right way to that. I don't really feel that way, but I'm happy that I was able to take some of these games and simplify them in such a way that it was very easy to gain complex behaviors from them. So my guard passing games are probably my favorite. I really enjoy the neutral games that I've created, like the guard passing games and the guard retention games. Guard utility games. Those are my favorite. I mean, I'm doing a lot with stand-up right now. So over the last year, I've been developing a lot of standing tactics games that are really cool. I like a lot, but they're a little tiring. They're hard.
I'm sure, yeah.
But no, I mean, because the thing is, they have to be constantly updated. You have to remember that we can start with a game that I've played, and I can give it to you. I say, hey, try this on your students. But it might have a different effect based on your room, your students, your culture, the way you deliver the game. It's going to have a different effect than mine. So you may have, you know, a similar response, but it's your ability to adjust it to your room, to your culture, to what you're seeing. That's the real magic. So I have to adjust these games all the time. And what's really interesting about skill is super sensitive to change. So typically I can get something to stabilize in 3 months, but if we don't regularly update it, it'll start to delete a little bit. You'll start to lose some sensitivity in that realm. And this is another reason why we play jiu-jitsu every day, which I always say to everybody. We always do a guarded game, we always do a standing game, we always do a pinning game top and bottom. We always do one pin chest to chest, one pin chest to back. We always attack the legs. So it's like there's not a day that goes by that we don't have some aspect of the whole engagement broken up into small component parts, and we always play the whole game every day. So, like, you know, a whole regular round. Because, like I said, what I'm finding is that you can't focus too much on one area for too long because it'll affect all the other areas. But sometimes we do. Sometimes we want to do that because we want to highlight something. So most recently, we've been really big into the standing grappling. We've been spending so much time on our feet, so much time in based positions trying to destabilize our opponent to the floor. But we've sort of removed a lot of the guard work. We've been focused more on the top positions player's perspective. And this has had a really interesting effect. So now all our guard players, their wrestle-ups are becoming stronger. Their abilities to get off their back is becoming stronger. So they're less inclined to go under and start playing the leg game, but now they're more inclined to come up. And I didn't tell them to do that. It just emerged. So anyway, everything affects everything.
Sure, yeah. And that's sort of like it's almost like you're including like spaced repetition in like playing the whole game every day, and that you're adding like a review element in terms of like making sure everyone has a well-rounded game or special. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I was going to say we do a class called the Rudiment, and the Rudiment is what my advanced guys do. It's from 7 to 8. So in the rudimentary class, we always keep those foundational skills high focus. So from the bottom, it's making, maintaining connection. It's managing distance for specific ends. And then there's the destabilization aspect. So when we play guarded games in the Rudiment, no matter what deeper level skill we're trying to access, we are always working on those three things. And that's why we call it the Rudiment, because there's not a day go by that we're not working on connections, distance management, and destabilization. And for the top position, we're doing the opposite. We're always working on breaking connections, closing the gaps in segmentation. We're always working on it. We never not do those things.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. That's awesome. I think I heard you mention like you like to sit on the side, like theory craft with your guys and like what's like the, and that's a very specific word from like gaming culture. So like, are you do you play like regular like video games outside of this, or is that like, or how's the, I don't know what how immersed yeah, into so, like nerd culture are you?
Oh man, we joke, like I'm a nerd demon. That's the thing. I'm like a demon nerd, you know? But I was a gamer my whole life. I was an RPG head when I was a young kid. You know, back when I was like 10 years old, I went to Blockbuster one night and I got Chrono Trigger and I was obsessed. And I just played that on Super Nintendo like crazy. And then, Final Fantasy VII. So that was me, right? I was like the RPG kid who would lock himself in a room for 3 days and just grind out these games. But then, I got into World of Warcraft in like 2007. And I played for a few years. And then when I broke my neck and I was out for a year, I went through this horrible phase of my life trying to figure myself out. And I became pretty obsessed with World of Warcraft. So I did a lot of that. And most recently, I just played Classic for like a few months, but I stopped.
I remember, in college, like the people called it War Crack because it's like just it can consume your whole life where they don't go to class and whatever. Like it's very addicting.
When I was raiding ICC and when I was playing Wrath of the Lich King back in the day, I was like the sixth ranked warlock on the realm. Desperately trying to get this trinket called the Dislodge Foreign Object. And I tried it for weeks. And I was obsessed. Like, I had to get that fucking thing. I was a min-maxer. I was on elitist jerks every day, just reading every post about what Affliction Warlock is supposed to do and how to max min the DPS. Like, I just went stupid with it.
So that amount of analysis in, like, Warcraft, like, that definitely applies, like, to jujitsu, where it's like you're able to like go full bore into like something and kind of analyze it to hell and back and like obsessive about trying to get better at it.
Well, I mean, I don't do anything that I don't, and that's why I have to be careful what the other things I do, because I truly don't believe in starting anything unless you think that you're gonna be the best in the world at it. And I know it's not possible. I do. I don't believe in starting anything without that thought. That's just me. I tore both my adductors and separated my pelvis a couple years ago when I was training. And so I had to stay out of jiu-jitsu for almost a year and a half. I couldn't even squat. Like, the doctor was like, the tear is so bad, it's about to rupture. And they were like, if you put a barbell on your back or if you get someone pushing into your open guard too hard, your hips are going to come apart. So I was like, fuck. So I had nothing to do, right? And this one night I was laying down watching a documentary. A climbing documentary. I can't remember. Oh, Meru. And it was about, Conrad Anker taking a crew up and climbing Meru. And I was like, man, I wonder if I would enjoy rock climbing. So literally the next day I went into Earth Treks and I walked in and I was like, yo, give me a pair of shoes, man. And they were like, all right. And then I signed up immediately. The dude was trying to sell me. I was like, just show me where the bouldering wall is and leave me alone. And so I walked in and I started climbing immediately 4 days a week. I was there 2 hours a day, 4 days a week. And then when I was done doing that, I started looking up physical training for rock climbing, and then so I would spend 4 hours a day, 2 hours bouldering, 2 hours physical training, and this is all before my jiu-jitsu classes. So for that whole year, and I also bought a rock wall too. I bought a tension board, and my whole intention was to become a V16 boulderer. It never happened, of course. Even the guys at the rock climbing gym were like, "You're probably gonna get tendonitis." I'm like, "You don't know who I am. Go over there. Go hang out with your softies. Leave me be." And they actually started calling me that intense jiu-jitsu guy. That's what I became noted as at the climbing gym. Anyway, hilarious. I don't get involved in shit unless I'm going to go full board.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I definitely have a similar, feeling of like I want to be the best at everything that I do, but I have a problem of like saying yes to a lot of things that I end up not intending on being the best at. So balancing that of like, okay, learning to say no and only like focusing on really putting all my chips into like the certain baskets and certain pillars of my life.
No, I'm sure. I mean, like 2 years ago, I was blessed by DeAndre Corbe and Gavin Corbe joining the team. And when DeAndre came down and he said, "Hey, I'm moving here, coach," and I was like, and that changed me. So that's actually why I stopped rock climbing. So the second he said he's moving here, I wouldn't cancel my agreement immediately. He's like, "I'm not wasting a second. I'm going to make sure this kid is going to be the sickest grappler in the fucking world." And so he said that's what he wanted to be. And I was like, "Man, I'm going to get you there. We're going to do I was like, "I'll drive anywhere. I'll do anything that you need. It does not matter. I'm at your beck and call." And so anyway, so yeah, I do that. Even with coaching, like now I'm obsessed with this coaching. I mean, I've always been obsessed with coaching really, but after having him come down, him dealing with him and his brother, these are the two hardest working individuals I've ever been around. Like, people really don't know. And I can't wait till, you know, DeAndre hits his stride and people get to start interviewing him and talking to him, because he's a different animal. But anyway, so yeah, even something like that, it drew me in completely, and I was dedicated to him as a student.
Awesome. Yeah. And it's a certain level of, like, stakes. Like, somebody is coming down to train specifically with you. So, like, you feel, like, yeah, obligated to, like, really, like, pull out all the stops for them.
I mean, honestly, I felt honored, right? So, like, even though my team has been a pretty winning team, I mean, so I think the big confusion was when I first started opening my school, it was called Lineage Jiu-Jitsu. And I went through some trademark battle with some fucking asshole about the name. And so I ended up losing a motion because my lawyer had some family emergency and whatever. So I just abandoned the name. I switched to Standard Jiu-Jitsu. And then so my school was like split. That's why people don't – the Standard feels like only 4 years old when Standard is actually 8 years old. So we were actually a pretty winning team. Like, all my white, blues, and purples were gold medals at everything. You know what I mean? World champs to pants to everything, all the opens. And then little Alex Nguyen, who's been my student, she was 12. She won worlds at all the teens. She won the teens pants twice. She won worlds at blue. She won worlds at purple. She now won worlds at black. And so but no one ever paid any attention to us. And nobody came to the gym. And so he really was the first guy that was like, hey, I'm moving here to train with you. And so I was like, me? Like, oh my God, dude, I'm your man for life. Let's go. You know, we're going to do this fucking thing. So.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's I mean, I would love to have him on the podcast, like, if he's open to taking whatever podcast requests or whatever. But
I'll talk to him. Cool. He might be. He's a very strict individual, to say the least.
Gotcha.
But yeah, man. Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. But I don't want to take up too much more of your time. But yeah, you mentioned before that you're offering training for coaching in your ecological approach. So you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, a few small things. So guys, even though I put up that post, you can still message me. I'm still going to communicate with everybody. You message me, I'm going to help you out. I'm going to give you tips. I'm going to try to help guide you in the right direction. I'm more than welcome to come on any podcast or things where people need some more information. You guys can reach out to me. My gym's open. Visitors still come by for free. Come still see me. But at the same time, I'm trying to orient my time a little better because I've been pretty overwhelmed over the last 6 months. I've been doing my best to give as much away as I humanly can, right? So now I'm going to start closing it up a little bit just so I can focus on some select individuals. So I'm offering some consulting services, some coaching services, and then I'm going to try to work with 10 individuals. I have 5 on board already, so I have a spot for 5 more. I'm looking for specifically any coach that owns a gym and is coaching full time. I'm not interested in your blue belt, your purple belt. I'm not. And I'm not saying that in a mean way. I just need to work with people who are really trying to do what I'm doing so we can build a little a team and work together at this. I figure if the more people I get on board, the more people I can help with my experiential knowledge and get you guys hit the ground running, we're going to make this shit spread like wildfire. So anyway, if you're listening to this and you're interested in something like that, you get to me quick because I'm filling these slots. So hopefully I'll be ready, but I'll be pulling the trigger in April, the first week of April. So anyway, if you hear this and you're interested, hit me up.
Awesome. Well, great. Thank you for jumping on, Greg. And I really appreciate your time. And I think this is, a big foundational change in how jiu-jitsu and grappling gets taught. And hopefully, that we see like more and more of it. And it just raises the grappling skill of the world, and we get to see more and more cool shit.
Yeah, man, I hope so too.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, awesome. Really, of course, you're welcome.
Awesome. All right, appreciate it. I'll see everyone later.